There we go. What's up, everybody? Luke Thomas. Time on deck is a little bit late. Well, 103 on what's the date today? What is the effing date today? May 28th, 2014. Today on the chat on the podcast, we'll talk about UFC 173, which was last weekend. We'll talk about, if you want, some of the early returns on pay-per-view numbers for Bellator. We'll talk about the not one but two UFC shows that are on Saturday, one in Germany in the afternoon and then one in Brazil in the evening, the Ultimate Fighter Brazil 3 finale. Lots of good stuff to get to. And then, of course, whatever questions and comments you may have about anything that's going on in the mixed martial arts world today. Best place to do that, of course, is on MMAfighting.com, which is where this little lovely window is embedded. So comments in the comments section of where this post is are the ones that will get reviewed. We already have a fair number up there, but always happy to get more, especially if they're really good. You can follow me on Twitter at @SBNLukeThomas, or you can email me at luke.thomas@sbnation.com. With that in mind, last thing. We're gonna do a little game from now on. So whenever you hear this noise, ready? Whenever you hear this noise, that's your cue to go and tell people that you're watching this. Tell people on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, at the bus stop, at the airport terminal, at the bed next to you if you're in the hospital. Wherever you're watching this, you gotta let folks know that you're doing that. Whenever I click that, that's when you tell everyone else. Okay? So with that sound in mind, I put out the bat signal. I need Batman, which is you, to show up and save me. All right. Now, with that out of the way, let's get down to business. Shall we? All right. UFC and Fox deal. Sure, where this question's coming from, but it got nine recs, so here we go. How likely will the UFC re-sign with Fox once their deal's up? Seems like the UFC is getting the short end of the stick out of this deal. The UFC has moved cross networks for Fox countless times, from FX to Fuel, and then Fuel being rebranded as FS1, and now a potential move to F. Well, this is just not correct information. FS1 was Speed, FS2 was Fuel, and they were on FX while they were on Fuel at the same time, while they were on Fox. But you're talking about FS1 and FS2 trying to acquire basketball rights. Fox isn't promoting the UFC as much as the UFC is promoting Fox affiliate networks. Agree or disagree? Well, again, had to get the facts right, number one. Number two, I think it's partly overblown. Fox Sports 1's not. I guarantee that whatever, I haven't looked at the terms of the deal with the UFC, but I guarantee you there's no deal where they spend inordinate amounts of time on Fox Sports 2. If you look at some of the games that they can do on Fox Sports 1, they can do them at a time where they can have a 10 p.m. start time on the UFC and still satisfy whatever contractual demands or whatever they're trying to set up with basketball. There might be more bumping than usual, or at least late entries into events. But, you know, it would make no sense for them to bump UFC in such a dramatic way. UFC has been a major win for them. If you look at the Fox Sports 1 history of all their major ratings, you know, some NASCAR events, I think maybe like one or two, and some other, I think college games and football have done really well for them. But then, like a huge chunk of the top 20 pieces of programming, live or recorded on the station, are UFC related. You know, so it would really be cutting off their nose to spite their face for no particularly good reason. Now, you know, there's no big question about whether delivering on Fox, major big Fox. I think that is a bit of a more debatable issue. But for Fox Sports 1 and Fox Sports 2, UFC content is a dramatic win for them. There's just no getting around it. You know, it's now are those numbers. The question isn't really is it good for Fox. The question is it good for UFC? Because so, for example, if you pull 700,000 people on FS1, or you pull, let's say, 250,000 people, or 150,000 people even, on Fox Sports 2, those are good ratings for those networks. The question is that enough for UFC? UFC being accustomed to 1 million-plus on FX, and then, of course, even up to 2 million-plus at times on Spike. Different era, different sport, but I'm sort of pointing out what they were accustomed to in terms of network promotion. So no, I don't think that Fox is going to really bump UFC in any particular way. It's not necessary. It's probably contractually in some ways forbidden. They must have a certain number of guaranteed shows that look a certain way. I bet they're doing it because they want to squeeze it into their calendar, you know. The thing I have on my mind, I can't quite shake, is that, you know, when Dana goes on and does, like, you know, I think it was for the Silva-Weidman rematch, when he took over, like, ESPN's Instagram and ESPN's Twitter or whatever the case may be, or their Facebook page, whatever social media outlet it was a part of, I still think, and this is just conjecture, I don't have any information, but I still think there's a part of them that wouldn't mind being in business with ESPN if they could. You know, a lot of these other leagues have their games and their fights, or whatever, their games, spread out across networks. You know, Fox, NASCAR is one of them. NASCAR is an exclusive Fox, as I don't recall them being. At least they didn't used to be. Certainly, all kinds of other sports, basketball is across networks, football is all over the place. You know, the question is, if there's that much demand, whether UFC would be able to do it. But I all I'm pointing out to you is I just don't think that Fox is in any way, you know, particularly upset with UFC as it relates to Fox Sports 1 or Fox Sports 2. Interesting question. Luke, if you were John Jones, what would be your strategy to beat Gustafson in the rematch and to beat DC? Well, that is a tough one. I sort of believe that John Jones is one of those guys that is always going to have a diverse game to win. Like, he can be really good in one thing, but he's not, like, he just doesn't have a specialty. His specialty is creativity. His special is adaptation. His special is decision-making. And sort of he has these other physical gifts as well. He's got a good enough wrestling base. He's got, you know, he's crazy sort of strikes he's managed to make, you know, usable. So for me, it's going to be that, which means figuring out a way to get the takedown on Gustafson. I mean, finding a way to not get jabbed constantly. Finding a way to cut off the cage on Gustafson. That to me seems important. If you give Gustafson space to operate, then he's going to do what he does. For Cormier, man, I don't really know. I that's a really tough one. I would say, I mean, the game plan that I just sort of said that he should use against Gustafson is true for pretty much anybody. But I just mean in tailoring in a way that works for his particular strengths, taking a takedown and sort of landing a shot, getting Gustafson to back up rather than just sort of sharing space in the middle of the cage with him. With Daniel Cormier, man, I think it's going to be keeping him at distance, you know? If Cormier gets in close, he's liable to get a... I mean, he doesn't have... Cormier shoots, you know, he's got freestyle takedowns, but in MMA he's got a lot of clinch takedowns, you know. What do you hit on Hendo, the step around throw? Came around the corner, you know, you're here, you come around the corner behind him, so that you're at least perpendicular, if not slightly behind, and then you toss them over behind themselves. You know, he has a lot of clinch takedowns. Once he gets on top, he's really heavy. You just don't want to be there. You want to really keep him at bay. So I think for Jones in the DC fight, distance and managing that distance is really going to be critical, which I think will be tested in part in the Gustafson fight. True or false, Ellenberger won't ever fight for a title. It's probably true. Eddie's next fight is with Will Brooks. You would think. I mean, they're trying. They're trying. Luke Thomas agrees with Eddie that Brooks is easier fight for him than Chandler. I do agree. I laughed when I saw the fans' impression of Chael at UFC 173. I didn't see it. Prime Dominic Cruz beats Dillashaw. I'd favor him. I don't know if he beats him. The power of Dillashaw is a bit of an X factor. Barao will be TJ's first title defense. I don't know. I thought they would do it, but they've been hemming and hawing. Aslan Sal's case is pretty strong. It's tough. But, I mean, Dillashaw versus Aslan Sal is like even as a rematch, just is, you know, promotionally speaking, a flat line. I get paid overtime covering back-to-back UFC events on Saturday. Okay. I watched 13 hours of MMA this Saturday. No. Dillashaw's best technique he used on Saturday was the triangle leap, the Senkaku Toby, where he gets behind the guy. Yeah, that was interesting. I read and enjoyed Jack Slack's How to Kill the King article. As a matter of fact, I did. I don't get to read those as often as I used to, but I got to read that one. It was very good. Arizona, UFC Arizona. What are your thoughts on the UFC finally heading to Arizona? What took it so long with the talent they have there? I'm not really sure what event is going to be there. I know about Albuquerque, but that's New Mexico. Then I know about San Antonio. What is the Arizona fight? Oh, wait. Am I great? Oh, Phoenix, Arizona. UFC on Fox 13. U.S. Airways Center. December 13, 2014. Why it took so long to have... Why I have to ask UFC about what their priorities were. Maybe it's how they feel about local markets in terms of what they can draw at the gate. Certainly, it's not one they've explored as thoroughly as others. You do have, as you mentioned, guys you can put there. I'm not sure what the reasoning is behind not going to Phoenix. It must be something if they haven't like really gone back to it extensively, though. Like, you notice they go back to Chicago for those Fox shows, Toronto being a major market. And Toronto's a bigger market than Phoenix no matter what, but there must be something about it that has been, not make them hesitant, but to be a little more discriminating with their timing. But as you mentioned, it's got all the reasons why they would want to go there. I actually was asking UFC brass at 172 why they haven't come back to D.C. I think D.C. is a really strong market, you know, for all kinds of reasons. You have a venue that would look good on TV in the Verizon Center, easy to get to right downtown. There's public transportation to get there, extensive cabs, and a healthy Uber economy. When I was in Memphis, man, like it was impossible to get tickets when I was there for Bellator 120 because, first of all, it's Memphis, and second of all, there was a there's a bus system, but there's no like real public transportation, and not a very robust one, not a very robust one. And then on top of that, they have a cab system there, but all those donks were taken up with the barbecue festival that was going on. It took like 45 minutes to get a cab at your hotel. It was bananas. But like in DC, man, you can just flip on your phone. If you have an Uber app right there, a Lyft app gets you. There's a metro system. It's walkable. Tons of hotels. It's a convention city. Everyone has money here, you know, relatively speaking to the rest of the country, both in the neighboring suburbs and in the city itself in Maryland and D.C. There's not one but three airports to get you here, a train station. Like, it just makes a lot of sense. And initially there was the D.C. commission would take a pay-per-view tax. I'm told that's no longer the case. And so I was asking guys at UFC, like, why don't you guys come back to D.C.? And they didn't really know what the answer was. They just didn't have a good one. They were like, I don't know. We just sort of been prioritizing other markets. It could very well be the case that Arizona's the same way, that they don't have a good reason for not going there. They just hadn't. They had other reasons to go other places for other sort of things they were trying to satisfy. Maybe Arizona got caught up in that. So at least the Phoenix market anyway. But your days of drought are over. Death in the Octagon. Do you believe a death will ever occur in the UFC? I hope not. What will be the impact on the sport? I mean, it's a very long, detailed question. I would say that I hope I never see it in my lifetime, but I wouldn't rule it out. It's always going to be possible. The question is just, what is the nature of the death? What does it look like? And who dies? And, you know, what country is it in? I think all those circumstances you have to add up. Is it a heavyweight? Is it a lightweight? Is it American? Was it a Canadian? Did it happen in Brazil? Did it happen in Macau, China? What were the causes? Was it medical malpractice, improper screening, you know, whatever the case may be, a referee that did a poor job. All those factors were sort of figured out. I don't think any one death. People always talk about like, oh, what happens if there's a death in the octagon? Well, context is important here, and I think all those different factors that define how we view this potential, disastrous incident will affect how the UFC wiggles its way out of it or not. By the way, I would be shocked if UFC didn't have already in play contingency plans for something like this about what their messaging might be and whatnot. But, you know, I don't think the chances are particularly high. I think it's a brutal sport between, you know, capable competitors. But the guys who typically get to that level, their bodies, I just feel like, you know, it sort of sounds like I'm saying that they're superhuman, but I'm not. I'm just simply saying I think, you know, I always talk about it before, like, there's so many good fighters out there, believe it or not, that just don't have an ability to take damage, you know. Like, they have great striking technique or great jiu-jitsu or great wrestling, but they just can't take a shot, either body or leg or the you know, accumulative damage to absorb in training. Like, they just can't handle it. You know, a really good fighter, I'm not saying he would have been a world beater, but, you know, Jonathan Goulet is noted as a really good fighter. Guy just didn't have much of a chin, you know. It's unfortunate. So as a consequence, there's only just a certain limit you're going to progress. Like, part of your ability to succeed in the sport, you don't have to have an amazing chin, but you have to have a pretty fair amount of durability. The guys who typically succeed and get to this level have a fair amount of durability. And with all the medical screenings that go with it, you know, the chances are fairly low, all things being equal. Biggest upset in UFC history. Sarah GSP was essentially the result of a devastating strike landed in round one. It's a problem. This is the problem when you don't trim your beard forever. Stuff just floats from your beard into your mouth. That was gross. Edgar Penn won was a fairly close decision, and Penn was never in any real danger. Will the fact that this division is in relative infancy affect the gravity of his dethronement, or is it safe to say this is the biggest upset in UFC history? From an odds perspective, it's much greater what Sarah did to GSP. There's just categorically different kinds of upsets. If you flip a coin 100 times, a two-sided coin, over time, the number of times it lands heads and the number of times it lands tails is going to be roughly 50%, give or take, right? You know, if GSP and Sarah fought 100 times, how many times would GSP win? Let's just assume the answer is 99 times out of 100, GSP is going to win. But that one time, Sarah is going to win. If they fought 200 times, there's going to be two times where Matt Sarah wins. It just so happened that the first time that they fought, that was that one coin flip, or that one moment, where Sarah's one chance to win came true. Doesn't change that if they fought 100 times, GSP would win the subsequent 99 fights. So beating him was one of those like shot in the dark moments, but it happened. With Barao and Dillashaw, I mean, that was a thorough examination of why Barao was not ready for Dillashaw, at least not that evening. You know, listen, there was plenty of rumors out there, and I think some of them very substantiated. I've heard some sources pretty close that Barao was very, very sick. Everyone's going to say, oh, you can't say anything that. Like, since when do facts about things not matter because it's inconvenient? Like, he probably was pretty sick. That doesn't mean that Dillashaw won't beat him again in the rematch. Maybe it's more competitive, but, you know, Dillashaw proved that he was certainly in the league at a minimum with Barao. Even if you want to say what the effects of the whatever sickness he had were tremendous. But the point being is that was, you know, from an odd standpoint, not the same kind of thing. And it was just sort of proof that the one guy was at least on par, if not better than the other guy. That's not the same as what happened with Sarah GSP. That was a lottery ticket, you know. So from an odds perspective, and then when you sort of look at what the talent was between those two, you know, Sarah GSP is just so infinitely bigger. And everyone wants to talk about, like, what it meant for the sport. You know, Sarah GSP didn't mean a whole lot for the sport in the end. I mean, it was good for Sarah coming off the Ultimate Fighter to win. But when you really sort of think about what it was, it may have had some lasting impact, certainly for Sarah and for the UFC creating a rematch. And you know, it's a blemish on GSP's career. Those things really matter. But I don't know who this is. Anyway, but it was just such a one-time thing, man. This one's not wrecked, but it's an interesting question. The analysis of MMA is one of the most perplexing things I've seen. Henan Barral loses in perhaps the worst performance in his life, and TJ Dillashaw wins the best performance of his life. Not taking anything away from Dillashaw, but it's not very popular to think that Dominic Cruz takes Barral. Almost unthinkable a month ago. I don't know if I would say it's unthinkable. Okay, fine, something unexpected happened. But DC Tools Dan Henderson, something everyone expected. People still forgot everything they said a month ago about John Jones. What gives? It seems that analysts and fight pundits may as well not say anything about these guys if they're just going to forget everything within a month anyways. Well, yes, first of all, a lot of MMA analysis is terrible. That's true. Second of all, I think what you have to acknowledge is that there's really, really, really bad recency bias in MMA. Just what you mentioned, John Jones comes off a win. Oh, my God, look at how good he looks. Then Daniel Cormier comes off a win. Oh, my God, look at how good he looks. But because the Cormier one happened closer or more recently than John Jones, as you mentioned, there's going to be some folks who are just who get into that recency bias. It's a real problem. It's a real problem with it. I feel like so in the Marine Corps, I did artillery, right? And in artillery, you actually the way the round lands, and this is just like a strained example, but I always think of it. Artillery is not a direct fire weapon. Like, you don't have to make direct contact with your target for it to have any kind of real impact. I mean, direct hits are nice, but not essential. It's an area weapon, and most of the rounds have 150 meter kill radius. So all you have to do is get it in the vicinity. So the Russians, who were historically in the 20th century the best at artillery, at least artillery tactics, invented a system called bracketing. And in bracketing, you actually intentionally a little bit overshoot your target so that when you measure above your target a little bit and you have how far you are, it enables you to calibrate more closely on the second shot over. So the target's here, you shoot over, you calibrate down, and then the bracketing gets closer and closer to what you're actually trying to hit. That's what I feel like MMA analysis is as a fighter's career continues, or as a matchup is announced and so forth, or if there's a fight and then there's a rematch. There's a real bracketing effect. Like, everyone overshoots initially, then they kind of overshoot a little bit, but a little less so, and so forth and so forth. But eventually they basically get to the nugget of who these guys are. Dillashaw is still fairly early in his career. First time he fought on pay-per-view, first time he headlined a UFC card, first time he headlined a pay-per-view card as a consequence. People don't know a whole lot about him. The problem with MMA analysis, like I always talk about it, I do predictions for the site. Dude, predictions are impossible. They're impossible. You can get guys who study film all the time and make bets on the odds, and they'll do better than the average person because they're like deeply invested in this process. But really, none of us will know what's going to happen. These guys are different in a space where you don't see them. When the pay-per-view ends, for the majority of fans and even the majority of media, we don't see these guys again until the next media tour, which can be 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 months. Dude, you become, if you're one of these guys at Dillashaw's age, where you're 26, 27, 20, 25, 26, 27, now 28, you know, you become a different person. The next time we see them, they just get better. Especially when the guys who can acclimate to the game quickly, like a John Jones, you know. This guy, the game just comes natural to them. It's impossible to say who you're going to get when TJ Dillashaw walks out on the stage. It's just, who's going to be up there? You just don't know, you know. And also, there's the circumstances of the evening. Let's just assume it was true. Let's assume that Henan Barral was sick and that he fought like crap in part because he had just zero energy and no reflexes. That's a real thing. That's a real thing. I mean, even if you don't want to accept that happened this time, can we all agree that can happen to somebody? So like, trying to make predictions about these things is impossible. Like, when I do the predictions post, every once in a while, I'll like analyze a fight and I'll get it completely right. Not just in how the guy, not just that the guy won, but in how the guy won. Right? So it happens. Right? So in some ways, that's easier to do in Bellator. When you have an 8-man tournament, these guys are fighting month. There's not that much distance between the two. You know, the guy who fought in the quarterfinals versus the guy who fought in the finals. If they happen in close succession like that, you can generally get a read on who the guy's going to be. You can't do that if it's 2 years. It's really, really, really hard to say. It's really hard to say. So is the analysis bad? Yeah, I mean, I think some guys are just bad at analysis. There's not a lot of numbers you can use that can really help you. The other part is, man, it's the sport goes dark all the time. You know, the sport goes dark all the time, and it only lights up in these, like, punctuated moments where, okay, then you get all the surge of information. That's what I wrote about in my thing on Sunday, TJ Dillashaw rewrites the universe. When UFC 172 ended, we had a certain sense about 173. some people predicted Dillashaw, and which I always love. There's always morons who come out like, I predicted Dillashaw was going to win. Yeah, but you're going to get the next 50 main events wrong, so who cares? But the point is, the conventional wisdom about Dillashaw was that he was going to lose, and he was going to lose pretty soundly. All the evidence we had pointed to that. The odds makers aren't morons. All the available evidence told you that that was going to happen. You had to read very deeply or just be guessing or be in Faber's camp and Dillashaw's camp to know that something was up. Otherwise, it just the best reading of the available evidence is what the odds makers told you. Odds makers didn't have Barao as a slight favorite. They had him as a monstrous favorite. The available evidence that we had to read from a rational perspective told you that Dillashaw was going to lose. But the reality is the available information that we have to make those decisions is woefully incomplete. So yeah, man, I'm going to do predictions for these two weekends fights and, you know, UFC 174. Do I have any effing idea who's going to win? I don't know. I don't know who's going to win. I have a better guess than I do other times, but I don't know, and neither do you. And most of the time, none of us ever will. That's just how the game works. But that is what creates the suspense, and that is when someone comes in and does something revelatory, like Dillashaw. It makes us rethink all these things about him and Barao and Dillashaw's past losses and John Dodson and Mike Easton and Dominic Cruz and Fate. It makes you rethink everything, you know, and that's what I love about MMA. Would I favor to beat Chris Weidman to beat the following guys at 205? John Jones, no. Gustafson, no. Rashad Evans, yes. Daniel Cormier, no. Glover. That's tough. Probably no. Johnson. I don't know, man. Probably not. Henderson, yes. Phil Davis, yes. Ryan Bader, yes. Emmanuel Newton, yes. My pay-per-view setup. Just wondering what environment do you usually watch UFC pay-per-views? Do you watch them by yourself or with a big group or with a couple of friends? I usually like having a big party with a big fight atmosphere. I watch, it depends, well, it's changed over the years. When I was on Bloody Elbow and then SB Nation for a while, I would have friends over, but there just became way too many shows for that to happen. A lot of my, DC is a very transient city, people come and they go. So a lot of friends are now gone. So the ones who I watch UFC with, much fewer of them today. I mean, you know, I can get guys from the local gym, but I don't. Anyway, so long story short, I always have either a computer. I usually have an iPad and two computers, or two computers and a TV, depending on how I'm watching it. If I'm watching the pay-per-view on TV, I'll have the two computers. If I'm watching online with UFC.tv, or, you know, or the Fight Pass, or whatever it is, then I'll have an iPad out for certain social media streams, plus the one for the computer, plus one for me to write on. As you know, UFC 173 did a live gate of 1.7 million and an attendance of 11,036. Since TJ rang Barao's bell on Saturday and took his title, do you see that as kind of a performance that can contribute to the popularity of the bantamweight division? I certainly don't think it hurts the bantamweight division, but whether it's a needle mover is it, I just don't see how that would work. He will benefit from the buzz that he generated after the fact, that is Dillashaw heading into his next title defense. But, I mean, there's just many more problems to consider here. One, if he fights Barao, that's a good rematch. They can do that. There's been a lot of hype behind Barao. That would probably help some with gathering some steam, but even then, that's not really a promotional powerhouse. Two, if they do it against Aslan Sal, as I mentioned before, I mean, that you can't even sell that. You have to just put that on Fox. This kid is basically brand new as an elite fighter that people should be forced to recognize. There's plenty of casual fans who, you know, you have to teach about guys like this. Those are the ones that really were to bring the big dollars, not the hardcore fans. That's not going to happen against Aslan Sal, even if we all agree Aslan Sal is a formidable challenge and a fighter deserving of a title shot. Irrelevant issue. And I guess I would say, you know, no, I don't. I keep saying this, man, like somebody's going to come along at one of these weight classes, you know, like I wish that, and maybe he will in the end, Dude, Conor McGregor is the best thing to happen to the lighter weight guys since BJ Penn in terms of attention. You know, like Jose Aldo is like, you know, what he did in WBC was incredible, and even to, you know, some extent in the UFC. And there's been all kinds of guys in the lower weight classes that are just technical marvels. And I appreciate every one of them for what they do for the sport. But, you know, these, I'm tired of hearing these criticisms about, well, lighter weight guys don't sell. Lighter weight guys do sell. They just don't know how to sell themselves. Conor McGregor is getting UFC to expand their business internationally in a way, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I know they want to go back to Ireland anyway, but, boy, he makes it easier because the guy gets out there and opens his mouth, man. Like, everyone was booing Michael Page at Bellator 120, and that's 170 pounds, but they were booing him not for his size, but for his dancing and his Harlem Shake. My God, dude, will somebody at 145 please do that? Will somebody at 135 please do that? Will somebody at 125 pounds please do that? What you need in there is a Mayweather-type guy, a guy who has unbelievable skill. Now, I know Mayweather's defensive. I don't mean that way. But I mean an elite fighter who has the ability to promote. These guys are terrible promoters. Terrible. Great guys, great fighters, a joy to watch, terrible promoters. Terrible. And that's what's missing in lighter weight. I think all this talk about, I mean, yes, listen, is there some natural preferences even for a rotund gentleman like Roy Nelson who has big power and can do big things? As I mentioned before, affect change. Heavyweights can affect change very quickly. The lighter weight guys have a bit of an issue with that, but even then they can still affect change too. You know, it's not so disparate that it's this issue where it can't be, it's insurmountable or something. This is a solvable problem, and it's solvable when someone gets out there and puts his finger on someone else's chest and makes people turn their head. It's doable. Conor McGregor is doing it. Whether or not he can back it up in the cage is a completely separate matter. But it's not been since BJ Penn that a lighter weight guy has done something like that to get you to look like that. And you don't have to like Conor McGregor. In fact, it's even better if you don't in some respects. But at least he's getting out there and he's trying to get you to care about him. He's trying to get you to pay attention to him. This is not a sport where the natural enthusiasm is so high, guys can go through and just not say anything. This is a sport where you have to kind of hustle the crowd a little bit. It's just, you know, two guys trying to punch each other in the face has a fairly limited appeal, except when guys are excellent salesmen. And UFC can only do, everyone's like, why doesn't UFC do more for these guys? I agree, some of the UFC attempts at promotion are just total fumbles, but some of them aren't, man. Some of them are really good. Some is the best that they can do. Like, how are you going to sell Demetrius Johnson versus Valiago Utsinov? How are you going to do that, man? What, because these guys are incredible fighters? Because Demetrius Johnson, when you meet him, couldn't be a nicer guy? And he's probably an awesome dad and a completely loyal, faithful husband that every woman would want? That's not going to sell pay-per-view buys. It's just not, you know, and you can be upset about it and cry about the way in which the business works, but that's not the business we're in. So at least that's only one component of it, is having the legitimacy that they bring. But there's more to that story. There's much more to that story. Unless these guys are willing to tell it, then this is going to be the fate that they have to endure for the rest of their career. Henderson, Hendo, made it clear he has no intentions to retire. The media has made it clear that they hope he does retire, and even Joe Rogan tried to nudge Henderson towards retirement in the post-fight interview. What are your thoughts on Dan Henderson and his future in MMA? Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll see how he looks at middleweight. I'd be curious to see him fight a couple more times, but I didn't get the sense that, like, you know, I mean, on paper, Henderson is an obvious candidate for retirement. You know, 43, has lost most of his last few fights, all that kind of stuff. Even when he won, he was hurt badly. But when the fight was over, my first thought was not like, oh, retirement. And my first thought was, well, his time is limited. That was a whooping, but that was a whooping that I was fairly certain was going to happen. You know, again, not that I know anything, but one of the few times I do get it right, it's, you know, Cormier did everything we thought he was going to do. I mean, so in the fulfillment of the obvious, I don't know that I'm necessarily feeling, ooh, you know, worries about his health. I will say, though, that for me, the trademark of Dan Henderson is, it's not that his power has declined. I mean, maybe his speed has a little bit. I don't know that his power has declined, but I think his defensive abilities, his ability to defend himself, has declined. And so that is problematic as he ages. But no, I didn't leave that fight being like, oh, retirement, this is the time. No, let's see what he does at middleweight first. And then if he looks poor at middleweight too, then okay. You know, and I know that he's always looked better at, or at least historically he's often looked better at light heavyweight than middleweight. But middleweight's interesting. Let's see what he can do there. You saw my coverage at Bellator. The thing that was really noticeable was that you made even light heavyweight fighters look small. If you interviewed a flyweight, it would resemble Gandalf interviewing Frodo. There's an interview on my YouTube channel with me and Demetrius Johnson. He has to do this. I swear to God. Dillashaw pay. I know we're all pretty much assumed that Barao would roll over Dillashaw fairly easily, even with that being the case. Pre-fight, I don't see how it's justified to be paying a main event title challenging fighter to a pay-per-view, 18 to show, 18 to win. I mean, it's the same fighter pay argument that we've had 1,000 times. Here's your question. If a fighter signs a long contract for pretty cheap, but then quickly rises up to a championship level early on in the deal, he shouldn't be struck with undercard pay. I agree, but we don't operate in a system where fighters have the kind of leverage to necessarily get those contractual demands, which we talked about before. I just can't go back into it. It's just too slow. It's a fair question. It's a fine question. Should Dillashaw be paid more? Obviously, but this is a topic we've explored so many times on this chat. I got to move on. Dana White said this about Jake Ellenberger in the Lawler fight. Quote, "But when you're in a big fight like that and you're down two rounds, you come out in that third round, you try to win, and Ellenberger didn't do that. He didn't do it in the McDonald fight either, so he's got a lot of work to do," end quote. This quote frustrates me because Jake did try in the third round, but he got hurt trying to make something happen. Thoughts? I thought Jake did much better than the terrible fight with Rory. Well, he did do better than the fight with Rory, but I was not, I don't know about Dana's quote one way or the other, but I was not particularly, just wasn't blown over by Ellenberger's performance. I thought that he got started slow. I thought that he had the ability to hurt Lawler more than he did. And I just feel like there was a general offensive hesitancy and a lack of urgency until the final, you know, with the exception of a few moments. And that cost him because there was no sense of, I should say, Lawler didn't lack for urgency. He was proactive right from the beginning. Even when he was blocking the right hand of Ellenberger. Even when Lawler was kicking the blocked arm of Ellenberger over and over, I mean, that hurts, it takes away your weapon. You're going to be hesitant to throw it because if you throw it, the kick might come. So I just feel like Lawler went out there right away, set the tone, and Ellenberger was fighting from Lawler's tone from there on out for the most part, you know, with a few exceptions here and there. So, you know, I don't know about if it was the third round issue as much as it was a general lack of forceful offense on the part of Ellenberger. Let's see something. Pound-for-pound estimation. I am perplexed by the pound-for-pound quasi-calculation based on the, quote, if the fighters were the same size, who would win, end quote. Each fighter dominates their respective weight class based on a set of skills that is effective for other fighters for that genetic makeup. Best examples, Kane, Speed, and Gastank for a heavyweight. Not that any of this is concrete, but I believe the estimation of pound-for-pound should be based on the level of dominance one displays against all others who can fight at that weight. Agree or disagree? So sure, I think that's exactly. I mean, the problem with pound for pound is not is the way in which we are thinking of it, which is what you articulate. Well, imagine these guys are all the same size, who would win? But that's a really foolish way of thinking about it. As you know, what makes Kane a potent force at heavyweight is his cardio. What makes Daniel Cormier a potent force potent force now at light heavyweight with his wrestling acumen and his speed and his athleticism, among other skills as well. You know, you go down to George St. Pierre and sort of the well-roundedness that he had, and at lightweight, or excuse me, at middleweight, you know, Weidman's our champion, but, you know, we can look back at all the years of dominance that Anderson Silva enjoyed. And so all these guys use their physical tools. John Jones, 84-inch reach, and his wrestling background as well, and he has a super high fight IQ and all these things. They're as you know, the physical body type works not just because they win, but it works for that weight class. They're fighting a set of guys who have certain traits and certain skills because of those traits. Your skills are a function of your body. How fast you run is partly, you know, yes, how hard you train, but also your genetic makeup. You know, yeah, there are guys. Usain Bolt is taller than most of his competitors, but you've seen that guy run. He's got the gallop of a thoroughbred horse, man. That is a genetic freak, that guy. Unbelievable what he is genetically made out of, you know. I mean, born to run. Incredible. A lot of the other guys aren't, Justin Gatlin and so forth. But you get the idea, like, to, you know, there's a reason why no one 4'11" is, you know, is winning high jumps. You need a certain kind of body type to reach a certain kind of level. Other guys can. And so when you say, well, we'll shrink these guys all down, or we'll somehow, you know, build these other guys up to make them different, the physics begin to stop working there. It's a poor way of thinking about the more important question, which is, okay, it's dumb to say we should all put these guys the same size. That's a dumb thing to say. But it's not dumb to wonder, okay, but there must be a way to decide which of these guys is the best fighter. Right? I mean, there must be something to the idea that there's one guy alive right now who is the best fighter. We generally agree that, you know, even with pitching, there's one guy who can, you know, baseball, there's pitching and there's hitting, and I know they don't hit in the AL League, but there's sometimes there's guys who stand out as, like, all-time greats, guys who are the best guys all season. On basketball, you know, it's a game where people play both offense and defense, but, you know, Kevin Durant was the MVP this past year, and then LeBron James before that. And in tennis, you know, there's a ranking. Now, that's one where guys of different sizes play each other. But there has to be some kind of way to think about that. And I guess the only way to do that is to say, what level of success and what level of dominance is required to cancel out all the variables between resumes or among resumes. In other words, if you compared Velasquez's resume to St. Pierre's resume, to Silva's resume, to BJ Penn's resume, or Hendo's resume, what level of success does Cain Velasquez have to achieve before, no matter what you can point to on those resumes, it doesn't add up to that one? Well, you know, Silva was a lighter weight guy, and he faced this level of competition. And this was in an era where some guys were still fighting in Japan, or whatever the case may be. When what does a guy have to do to be so good and so dominant that those things don't ultimately undercut the argument anymore? I think that is what you need to be asking yourself. And these are very difficult questions to answer. I think it'd be shocking to find unanimity. I still believe that the idea of Silva as the best ever is slightly overblown. I still think St. Pierre's resume, from a resume standpoint, is pretty damn impressive. I think right up there neck and neck with him. I know St. Pierre says otherwise, and lots of other people say otherwise, but I'm just sort of pointing out it's at least at a minimum St. Pierre's in the conversation. I don't think all the variables are canceled out. But I think that's what we're looking for, is just some kind of evidence, some kind of mark of dominance, some kind of success that you can point to and say, it's just not possible. It's just not possible for X to be greater than Y, given what Y has done. And these will be difficult questions to answer. But that's sort of how I look at it, is like, pound for pound is a way of measuring dominance, not the way of measuring who's the best. We all agree that somebody out there is the best, right? We all agree about that. Pound for pound is a way of, like, what if these guys were all the same size? That's a weird way of trying to answer the question. I think a better way is just sort of trying to think about when you cancel out the different variables, when the variables no longer matter anymore. I think that's when you reach the level of success. Khabib said in a recent interview that he's a bad matchup for Pettis. He referenced the Clay Guida fight as evidence. Do you agree? I don't agree. A much better fighter, Anthony Pettis is these days. I don't think Clay Guida would do that to them again at all. And secondly, y'all know I love Khabib Nurmagomedov. I'm a little bit worried about his lack of finishing. Because the truth about Anthony Pettis is he needs just a few seconds to change everything. He needs just a short window, man. Nothing. And the whole fight can change. All it took were those four body kicks that he landed on. It sounds like a lot, but when you go back and watch the tape, it's just one after the other. That Pettis landed on Henderson as Anthony put it, to make him change his face. Like, you know. And then your decision-making begins to change. I think that's the reality there. So I'm not saying Khabib can't beat Anthony Pettis, but I wouldn't. If he's thinking that the Clay Guida fight is proof that he's just going to hold this guy down, he's got another thing coming. Were your pants off or on when Alvarez and Brooks got into it yesterday on the MMA Hour? They were on because I was at work. I was here. True or false? Robbie Lawler, Matt Brown goes the distance. False. Again, I don't know what's going to happen in MMA. I don't know what's going to happen in the UFC fights. However, and y'all are going to call me a hater, and it's fine. I'm not saying Matt Brown hasn't earned it. I'm not saying I'm not looking forward to it. But I think at the end of the day, I think Robbie Lawler's got that one in the bag. The Berlin card is better than the Brazil one. True. Could out-handsome Ben Folks. Sure. I don't know. Wizards make it past the second round the next 3 years. That's true. I'd rather watch pro wrestling than say something nice about the Dallas Cowboys. No, that's not true. Bagutinov goes the distance with Johnson. False. McDonald beats Woodley. False. I like Woodley in that one, y'all. Not trying to take something from TJ, but was Barao off? He didn't check a single leg kick all night. Now, nor do I recall him throwing a single leg kick, which seems off for a Noel fighter. Do you think the big overhand right in the first changed the fight? Well, certainly there's a question of, but did he even recover from the first round? You know what I mean? Was he even there? But yeah, I mean, I just don't think that was the best Barao I'd ever seen. Partly because TJ made him look that way. But again, everyone's going to be like, oh, you're taking away from TJ Dillashaw. Man, read what I wrote. I'm not taking anything away from TJ Dillashaw. But if somebody is sick, and believe me, I have all the reason in the world to believe it's true, does that not matter? You know, I know some guys persevere through it. Some guys don't. Some guys get really sick. So this is kind of why I want to see a rematch. I would still probably favor TJ in the rematch, but it's hard for me not to think that wouldn't be a lot closer. I mean, TJ was able to move as he wanted to. Would he be able to do that if he were really busted up with leg kicks? Do you think Daniel Cormier has the best MMA wrestling in the UFC? How many times do you think he takes down Jones Gustafson in the five-round fight? He's got some of the best MMA wrestling. I think he can take down both Jones and Gustafson. How many times? I don't know. Ben Henderson, Rustam Habilov. How do you see this one playing out? I haven't thought much about this one. I wonder if Henderson's going to lose this late or lose this early and then rally late. That's sort of how I feel about it at this point, but that may change as we get closer to the fight date. We see Floyd fighting next. I don't know. Amir Khan. I don't think they're going to do a Maidana rematch based on the pay-per-view returns. Probably Amir Khan. Someone they can sell against. Someone that can definitively cross the $1 million or the million mark for pay-per-view. Hector Lombard versus Donghyun Kim. Man, that's a really tough one. Hector Lombard's takedown defense is amazing. But it's only a 3-round fight, right? Because on that same card, Bisping and Lee are the main event. I'd have to favor Lombard. I think he's, you know, Lombard's just hard to put away, man. He fades, I agree, and I can see Kim taking a round, but I don't see Kim taking him down, and I certainly don't see Kim holding him down. I'd probably favor Lombard early. How much are you salivating over the bout between Lawler and Brown? I'm like y'all, man. Don't get me wrong. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be great. It's a great main event. I'm not hating on the fight in any respect, but I just feel like I'd be shocked if Lawler lost. Shocked. I think Lawler is about to go in there and start hurting people. I can't think of how strange it is for some of us fans and media to compare TJ Dillashaw to Faber. While they are both teammates, we now know just how different they truly are as fighters. One is arguably in his development stage and peaking, while the other is still relevant but at the later stage of his career. It seems to me that Dillashaw's success was a culmination of many years of sport-specific training vastly overlooked by the outside world. My question is TJ Dillashaw a special fighter, and are we all victims of the UFC's promotional machine? I'm not really ready to declare him like one of those guys. You have to do more than beat Barao, man. You got to beat a lot of dudes, right? You got to beat Barao again. You got to beat Aslan Sal. You're going to have to beat Dominic Cruz. He beats those three, okay, and now we're cooking with gas. But one win, while legitimate and real, and certainly he's positioned himself as one of the division's elites. When you start thinking about, like, irrespective of weight class, guys who you're like, man, that guy's incredible. TJ Dillashaw had the performance of his night, man, but he's got to put that together night over night. And he just simply hasn't done that yet. He may. He hasn't had a chance to do it yet. That's what has to happen. I'm not really ready to, It's the same with Chris Weidman when he won. When he beat Anderson Silva the first time, he was still the underdog the second time. You have to do this over time. He's got to beat Machida, and he's got to beat Jacare, and then we're going to be like, okay, you know, this is a formidable talent, you know. Assuming he does it, of course. Was Barao versus Dillashaw the best bantamweight fight ever? No. It was the best. Might be one of the best title fight upsets ever in MMA history. I might go that way. What are your thoughts on the current state of the welterweight division? Just curious as to what you rank as the most competitive division and also, if not, the most exciting. It's always going to be welterweight and lightweight. That's across MMA. Featherweight's getting there. But for some reason, I think that 145 to 170 slot is like MMA's sweet spot. You're going to have bigger stars in heavyweight. Obviously, the top 10 right now in middleweight is great. John Jones is maybe the best fighter ever. But I think in terms of depth of roster, like, it's not coincidental that, like, Bellator has good lightweights. It's not coincidental that World Series of Fighting has good lightweights. But they don't have hardly any good heavyweights. Those are just that's where MMA works itself out. Be it reasons of those guys, there just happens to be more of those guys trying. Those guys are big but not big enough to play pro sports, and that's what they end up as. There's all kinds of factors that may explain why that's the case, but like 145 to 170, those weight classes, that's your sweet spot right there. Okay, MMA journalists and their MMA fighter spirit animal. Okay, Luke Thomas is Ben Askren. Maybe. Kid Nate is Pat Miletich. No. Jordan Breen, Anderson Silva. Sure. No. Breen's talkative. Errol Hawani, Chuck Liddell. I don't know. Brian D'Souza, Frank Shamrock. That seems good. John Morgan, Roy Nelson. That's okay. Ben Folks, John Jones. Yeah, maybe. Jeremy Botter and Matt Hughes. No, that's not fair to Botter. Underdogs. Yeah, that's a good question. In the last 2 months, or since Fight Night 38, underdogs have won 38 of 80 UFC fights, or 41.3%. In 2013, underdogs won around just 27% of the time. Do you assume this increase in underdog wins is an anomaly, or do you think odds makers are poorly adjusting their evaluation of the ever-growing UFC underbelly of tough-level undercard fighters, convinces them into thinking they're known quantities before they hit a bump in the road? I think I talked about it before. Again, like, how many times on those cards did you look at them and say, man, the odds are just really off on this one? Now, I know Dana's always saying, man, the odds are unfair on this one. Like, he did a UFC 172, like, oh, Glover's like a 4 or 5 to 1 underdog. It's not fair. Turned out it was very fair. That's exactly what it was. But, you know, he's got a job to do. He's trying to sell his show, so I understand that. I'm talking about the odds makers, right? What was Barão? 9-1 favorite, something crazy like that? Who, again, there's always going to, you could literally book a guy to shadow box and someone's going to pick his shadow to win. And there's always somebody who's going to come out, I picked Dillashaw. I don't know what's wrong with you guys. Well, okay. Thank you, Nostradamus. When you get the rest of the year's main events wrong, let us know about your predictive abilities. But the reality is most observers, most rational and informed observers did not think that he was going to win, and they thought by a landslide Barão was going to win, but you're working with incomplete information. I think ultimately that's the problem here. I would have to look at the nature of the upsets more closely, how young were the guys who did it. I had to watch the fights, at least the endings again, to see how it happened. Because I think some of those are fluky just naturally in the way that MMA is fluky, and then there might be something else going on a little more substantive because these numbers are kind of crazy. But I just think that everyone in MMA is working with – that's why MMA certainty is, like, so crazy. You know what I mean? Everyone's like, man, this dude's got no shot. It's like, it's like, dude, this is a sport that makes you pay for certainty. Everybody, coaches, fighters, promoters, media, bettors. This is the last sport you want to be you don't want to hedge. Right? Like, that's why in this sport, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons to want to be competent at your job, but one of those is that so I can, when I talk to you here, when I write, I know I'm still going to be wrong because that's just the nature of the human condition, but it's that so I can have enough information to give you at least an informed choice, an informed opinion. Informed doesn't mean right. It just means informed. That's the best you can hope for. But no one was looking at those cards going like, man, these odds are just off. Did you not see this dude's last 2-3 fights? Most people were looking at those, including people who gamble, and they're like, yeah, these seem about right. There's always a couple of fights on a couple of cards where you're like, you know, I don't know about these odds. That's an inevitable, you know. That happens all the time. That's not you're talking about 33 underdogs and one in 80 UFC fights. And also, by the way, on Bellator. In Bellator 2, you know why? I think it's partly the quirkiness of MMA and partly we're just operating in a space with incredibly, incredibly limited information, and maybe more so than usual, because there's more guys than usual. After finally getting a champion in the gym, do you think this could heal the rift between Ludwig and Faber? Probably not. I don't think that's going to fix what initially caused the problem, right? Good question. Most recently, you touched on Katsunori Kakuno and his fight against Tony Ferguson. I'm a little confused about your stance in regard to this contest. Are you saying the UFC specifically made the particular matchup in hopes that Ferguson's more traditional stand-up techniques would prevail over Kakuno and his highly unusual fighting stance to prove a point? To me, I'm certainly no expert. Seems that Kakuno's fighting style would be highly susceptible to fail against most decent fighters in the division. If this is the case, how truly marketable is he even to Japanese fans? Well, I think he's probably very marketable to Japanese fans. I don't think he's a major star, but, you know, being a guy who was a judoka and a karateka and being Japanese and having a quirky style is always going to help you in Japan. But, you know, I don't know. I don't hold too hardly to that, too sternly to that. I don't think they were actually trying to send a message. All I was sort of pointing out was, like, in retrospect, the bout was kind of weird. And I said that going into it, man. That was one of those fights where I was like, there's times where you're like, well, you know, even if you get the prediction wrong, you can be like, well, I think this might play itself out. And maybe it does, and it turns a different way, but that dynamic is in play. And I couldn't quite get my head around what was going to happen there. I just didn't know, with the layoff between Ferguson, but his big reach and his big power against maybe with the sniping style of Kakuno, and I just didn't know how it was going to go. And in the end, it wound up being a bit of a blowout. And I was just like, well, why did they book this blowout? You know, maybe they didn't book a blowout. Maybe it just sort of happened that way, you know. So I'm not holding I don't think in the end necessarily that they were actually like, take this out of business promoters. I was just sort of pointing out that in retrospect, it seemed like an odd fight to make, that maybe Kakuno could have been given someone that was, you know, versus a guy who was a winner on The Ultimate Fighter, a guy who maybe was, you know, on the cast or something. What fights are you looking forward to this weekend and why? Main event. God, I haven't even looked at these cards, man. This is how prepared I am for this chat. Certainly Musashi and Munoz, I'm interested. Certainly Miocic and Maldonado. The Maya fight I'm looking forward to. Let's see. Carmon Dalloway, no. Bernard Strickland, no. Nina Maki and Nicholas Backstrom. Size for old Nina Maki. That dude is nasty, man. Let's see. Yuri Alcantara versus Von Lee Alcantara. Man, he is going to walk over him. Let's see. And then that's it on that card. On the other next card, I am looking forward to the Maya fight. Yeah, not much. Oh, Pedro Munoz versus Matt Obar. Pedro Munoz is a dope fighter. I like him. And that's about it. Oh, Demente Abreu is fighting. Demente is world champ jiu-jitsu guy out of Vanderlei's gym, who teaches jiu-jitsu in Vegas. So I like him a lot. Zuffa's treatment of John Jones. It seems that Zuffa really doesn't like John Jones all that much. First he fights last month, and all week Dana White can talk about how Henry Burrell is the best. Well, I don't know if that's related to John Jones as much as a guy trying to sell a fight with not much to sell it on. Now they announce a Jones title fight without him actually agreeing to a fight. Zuffa typically likes the company men like Hughes, Chuck, and Franklin, but they need stars. Is their treatment of Jones indicative that they'd rather have nobody they can control than a star they can't? I certainly feel like there's a bit of a rift there. You know, you could feel it when you were in Baltimore, for sure. Not like a I hate you rift, but a we have a different way of doing business kind of thing. Maybe I'm overreaching, but that was just sort of my sense in watching it, that Jones sees himself as somebody who can do great work with the UFC. I legitimately think that's true, that he can see that if he knows that if he partners with the UFC that there is mutual benefit to be had. But that, I don't know that he sees himself like a part of the UFC. I think that is something where he hasn't quite crossed that threshold. And certainly this is maybe a way for him to lean on Jones to accept the fight under the terms of which they've done it. A bit of strategy. Yeah, I just feel like John Jones is a very independent guy, for better or for worse. He wants to make decisions that, you know, uniquely benefit him. Not like solely benefit him, but strongly benefit him. and he is hard to bend, you know. He's very much his own guy. But I also feel like the UFC, I criticized them for a long time for, you know, and they buried him after UFC 151, which was a bad idea. You know, I think they're still kind of paying for that a little bit, to be honest. But I do feel like they finally turned a corner in that last fight. And I know the pay-per-view returns weren't great. They were, what, 350K? I mean, that's not bad, but that's not, you know, for one of their stars, that's not where it should be. But partly that was because they're facing Glover Teixeira and a few other factors. I think they're finally getting around to promoting John Jones the right way. I think when you talk about his greatness, talk about his potential, and then you can match him up with another star, you can match him with somebody else people are interested in seeing, I think you can do great numbers. I really believe that, you know. But also, man, like I was looking up yesterday, you know, hold on. I was looking up yesterday, okay, so if you went by signals and noise column, you know, I did an examination of all the live gates and attendances, attendance figures anyway, for all the previous Memorial Day shows that UFC has done. And they've done them from 2006 on, although I think in 2006 or 7 it was in LA. But they've done them all on Memorial Day, and all but one has been in Vegas. They didn't do it in 2005 or 4. And then after that, it's just pre, you know, it's SEG era. It doesn't matter at that point in terms of our discussion. Lyoto Machida versus Rashad Evans was UFC 98. That was a Memorial weekend show. Also on that card was Matt Hughes, Matt Serra, and Sean Sherk versus Frankie Edgar, although that was the opening bout and went to a decision. Other fights in the card, Drew McFedries versus Xavier Fupa-Pocom, Professor X, and then Chael Sonnen versus Dan Miller. On the undercard, you know, not particularly impressive, right? Do you know what that did in pay-per-view buys? 635,000. That's almost what Jones versus Evans did. 635,000. Dude, do you understand? We are living in a different pay-per-view era. And you could say, well, you know, UFC is not doing what they once did on pay-per-view, and that's true. I don't know if it's because of oversaturation, which has been one of my theories. I think we also have to grapple with the idea that pay-per-view is not what it used to be. Mayweather can't even cross a million. You know, I mean, yes, he did it with Canelo, right? I mean, I think people will still come out of their pocket for pay-per-view. I truly believe that. But when Mayweather is 1-for-3 on crossing a million on pay-per-view, or, you know, maybe he got just at 1 million for the Guerrero fight, dude, pay-per-view is not what it once was. Can you believe? I mean, if you put up Evans versus Machida today, what would that do on pay-per-view? It wouldn't do 635,000. And Sean Sherk and Frankie Edgar were not pay-per-view draws at the time. So Hughes, yes, and Serra, sure. But that's just two fights. That did 635,000 on pay-per-view. We're just living in a new world, you know. I don't see how Jones versus Gustafson. If Jones versus Gustafson does less than 635,000, which I'm sure that it will, you know. I'm not sure. It's very, very possible that it will. Then you know we're just completely operating in a different space. Bellator pay-per-view numbers. What do you think about the reported 50 to 65K number? Would it have sold more with Alvarez on the card? Let me tell you what I heard internally from the folks in the various positions in the Viacom family. And you can take us for what it's worth. I'm just going to repeat what they, not like word for word what they told me, but the basic sense. The basic sense was that with the last minute injury, given all the programming that they had to like nix and how it changed everything, they thought 50 to 75 was doable. You know, I think they believed that if they had kept Alvarez on the card, that 85 to 100 was possible. Right? So that sort of tells you what they were looking for. At the high end, they were looking for 100K in pay-per-view with a complete card they were able to promote from beginning to end with the various actors and stars. When I say actors, I don't mean like actual thespians. I mean like people on the card that they wanted to do that with. So, you know, is that possible? Do they have delusions of grandeur? I don't know. I think 65, since it's right in that wheelhouse between right in that bracket between 50 and 75 is pretty good, all things considered. I don't think they made hardly any money off of it. But that's not the point. The point is, can they go to pay-per-view again and make money at some point? And, you know what was good about the Bellator show? Dude, they promoted a show. Like, that sounds so crazy. Like, Bellator, like, effectively promoted a show. They did it. Even with a late injury to their main event, they did it. They did a ton of web traffic for that. They had a lot of interest in it. Again, how much of that translated to pay-per-view buys, well, that's a little bit different. You know, I didn't know that pay-per-view was, the Bellator product was ready to be behind a paywall, but, you know, they effectively promoted a show. Whether they got their money back, I don't know. But that, to me, is the interesting figure here. From what I noticed at UFC 173, Barao had a lot of trouble with the angles, number of strikes, and footwork of Dillashaw. It made me wonder how Cruz would have done. Cruz has some of the best footwork in MMA. Am I wrong in thinking that Dillashaw was as good but a bit more power to strikes? Yeah, that to me is the difference. First of all, the footwork is not identical. Cruz has a bit more of active footwork. His feet are much more in motion. He sets up angles and stuff too, but he's really kind of always in a rhythm, in a dance. He never sort of gets flat-footed and then starts it up. His feet are always in motion, and he's got these much longer, complicated patterns that he's worked out. So in that sense, it's different. But that also, as you noted, Dillashaw has more power. So I think it's fair to say that one of Jack Slack's criticisms was that if you can tag Barao and get him to a firefight, he'll basically just plant his feet and throw as he stands. It seems reasonable to conclude that Cruz would be able to pot shot him one or two times, change angles, move in and out, change angles again, and then keep popping a Barao who would sort of stay stationary and fire forward. In the end, we won't know until they compete, but the footwork is not identical, and the power quotient that Dillashaw brings changes our analysis a little bit. Yeah, which fight is the standout? I don't know which fight is the standout besides the main events for this weekend, but Tom Nienemaki is the one you got to keep your eye on. That's the guy who can do things. Luke, with all the talk from Eddie and Will on the MMA Hour yesterday, do you think Bellator will put them against each other? I don't know, man. I know Bellator probably doesn't want to. Dude, what would be worse for Bellator? For Brooks to beat Chandler, however controversially he won, then Chandler having already lost to Alvarez, and now Alvarez beating Will Brooks, and then he's done, and he goes to the UFC. Like, they would be like, oh my God, what would be worse? What would be worse? You know they don't want him to fight Will Brooks. I haven't had any talks with them. I don't know. I would be shocked if they wanted to make the Will Brooks fight. That doesn't mean they won't in the end make it, or that Will Brooks won't win. But for me, like, if you're asking me who I favor between Brooks and Alvarez, I think Alvarez has a point. Alvarez has pretty good takedown defense. Brooks had, against Chandler, some decent ground to pound, but I think he'd have a little more trouble with Alvarez. And on the feet, man, Alvarez, would light Brooks up. Light him up. He's a bad matchup for Will Brooks. You know, again, Will Brooks can rise to the occasion. I thought Dillashaw was going to lose. You know, we're only talking with what the information that we have is. But my reading on that information would be that it's a favorable matchup to Eddie Alvarez, all things being equal. Not an easy one, but a favorable one, ultimately, in terms of his chances for victory, yes or no. It would be devastating for them. Devastating for them to have put all this promotional muscle. I mean, yes, you'd still get the Chandler-Brooks rematch. So I'm not saying all would be lost, but that would just look terrible for them. Terrible. And then, of course, Eddie would go out and slam them, you know, which would be his right, in the media. Oh, it would be disastrous. Dillashaw versus Cruz. Yeah, that's the fight I want to see more than anyone. Everyone's like, what about Cruz Barão, Cruz Assunção? How about Cruz versus Dillashaw, boy? You know what I mean? One guy is quicker, speedier, a veteran. I would argue that Cruz has probably some of the highest fight IQ in the game versus a guy who's got very good footwork, very good athlete, and more power. How does that change everything? Both good wrestlers? Dude, that's the one I want to see. Cruz versus Dillashaw. That's my jam right there. Poverty breeds pugilists. My question is fairly straightforward. Does this oldest of boxing aphorisms still hold true in combat sports today? Yeah, I mean, the reality is you can get guys like Faber who had good parents and went to college and are just intensely competitive, you know, but or BJ Penn who grew up wealthy. You know? But the reality is I think for a majority of guys in fight sports, Pat Miletich put it best, you can get guys from all walks of life, but generally it helps if you've had an S life. Right, that's the reality. I mean, it turns you. It steals you and turns your appetite for a certain outcome. You know, you just people who haven't had to fight and claw and scratch and survive like that don't know how to bring themselves to. You know, guys who are poor who have no options and have had to deal with any number of challenging life situations. Dude, they bring a certain hunger to competition you just simply can't match, man. And until you felt it, like, dude, I keep telling people, man, like, all you need is a year of training to really, not really understand fighting, but to understand fighting in a way where you can make some informed judgments about it. Get 1 year of training under your belt, right? And find the guys who, it's funny, people were talking about the Dillashaw, or not Dillashaw, the Barão thing. I one time was interviewing Lamont Peterson in D.C., it's in Southeast D.C., and I remember this was during a media event there. Who was he fighting? It was not Khan. It was, or maybe it was before the second Khan fight was canceled. I remember the media there, TV stations there, and I go to the bathroom, and there was a kid in there who was just hitting the heavy bag. I mean, he could not have been more muscular. African-American kid. And he was washing his clothes in the sink. And then he washed him with soap that was from a shower stall that had no curtain, hosed himself off, and then dried it in the dryer. But, you know, it's only going to get so dry. And then got on, like, the most rickety-looking bike you've ever seen and left after he hit the back. I'm like, I don't know why he just did that, but I'm guessing he did that because he had no other option. That's the last kind of kid I would ever want to compete against. Because the misfortune and the lack of luck that he was born with, combined with his desire to get out of that, is going to turn him into a junkyard dog. Right? I mean, at some point, skills win fights, so you have to have all the skills. But, man, you would be surprised what poverty and, you know, abuse and tragedy, sometimes it can break you, and sometimes it can turn you into a merciless marauder. And there's just a common overlap between guys who've had tough, tough lives and guys who are willing to go to unbelievable lengths to put it on you and who have a certain appetite for violence, a certain degree of acceptance with it that other guys don't have because they haven't had to. Like, it's not common that everyone, like, watches these fights. It's not common that everyone can have an appetite for doing that to somebody else. You know, maybe some guys are born with it, but I think you have to be taught that, to be perfectly honest. And if you get taught that early and often enough, you know, it's not a very difficult moral calculation for you down the line. Do I believe the Jamie Varner fight should have been stopped? Yes. Under the unified rule, should it have been stopped? Yes. Where I talked about Cruz versus TJ. I'll do one more true false here. TJ Dillashaw will beat Henan Barão in a rematch. True. Jake Ellenberger is on the brink of being cut. No, false. Matt Brown versus Robbie Lawler will be Fight of the Year candidate. Probably true. Michael Johnson will beat Josh Thompson. False. John Jones versus Alexander Gustafsson II will do over 600K buys. False. Dominic Cruz will come back and fight Takeda Mizugaki. It's a good call. He might. True. UFC Fight Night 42 is the best Fight Night card on paper. False. Brendan Schaub will beat Andrei Arlovsky and be a fight away from a title shot. False. Yeah, although maybe. Maybe. He's got good takedown defense. Johnson versus Bagotinov will do at least 300K buys. Absolutely not. All right, let's take a look at Twitter. Luke, your thoughts on Chael saying Varner is the boy who cried wolf? I don't think that's very fair. Where does Chandler fall in the lightweight ranks after the loss? Out of the top 10, for sure. Is the Dominic Cruz style of fighting the one that can be used to beat champions? Boy, a lot of interest in Dominic Cruz now that Dillashaw is a champion. That's interesting. I mean, I guess there was always some with Barao as well, but lots of interesting questions about that with Cruz. Some champions, some. I think Cruz is going to have trouble with guys who are able to make adjustments on him and guys like Dillashaw have good power, so we'll see. There are now reports that Bellator pay-per-view did over 100K buys. Someone link to me anything that says Bellator did over 100K buys on pay-per-view. Because I haven't seen anything. If they did, then that's just a monstrous win. Do you have any comments and thoughts about the UFC's new background checks? About time. They I know it's probably expensive. I know it's probably another bureaucratic headache for them. But this is the reality of being a sports league as opposed to just a top-ranked promoter. If you're top-ranked, you don't have that same bond with your guys. You haven't branded them, and the top-ranked brand isn't as valuable. The UFC brand is a valuable brand. If you're going to put it on guys, even if they are independent contractors, you know, technically speaking, wow, Greg Savage is saying 100,000 pay-per-view buys for Bellator. I'd be shocked. That's craziness. You know when he broke the Eddie Alvarez story? Wow, Sherdog reported it. That's crazy. That's crazy. The source, speaking on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to release the buy rate data, stated that the information will be readily available in Viacom's SEC filings later this year. Bellator MMA CEO and President Bjorn Revenue spoke exclusively to SureDog.com Wednesday morning about his company's first pay-per-view performance. Quote, I'm never going to be in the business of confirming pay-per-view numbers, but I'll tell you this. Going into the show, I would have been very disappointed with anything less than 100,000 buys. Sitting here, despite our losing main event, I could say I am not disappointed at all in how the show performed. Dude, if they did 100,000 buys with freaking Alvarez falling out, that is a major win. Major win. I am shocked. I am shocked. I have to confirm that. I got to find a way to confirm that. That is incredible. That is incredible. Wow. Wow. I don't even know what to say. Was TJ Dillashaw's performance the most substantial improvement a fighter has shown between fights? Kenny Florian showed good progress over the course of his career. But yeah, that might be the biggest 1-2 punch I've seen in a while. If Brown beats Lawler, do you think the winner of McDonald-Woodley deserves the next shot? After Brown, maybe. any news when Mayhem Miller returns to the cage? Rampage told me it was soon, but he didn't really give an official timeline, but I guess this year? Let's go back, finish this off. Matt, if they did 100,000 buys, I don't even know what to say about that. That would be bananas. Bananas, man. Bananas. What are your thoughts on Joe Rogan's commentary in the main event on Saturday? It sounded like everything TJ did was the greatest thing since sliced bread, and even said this was better than Buster Douglas beating Mike Tyson. Well, I think what was Buster Douglas? 42-1 underdog, so it's not in that same realm of upset. And plus, you know, not just from an odds standpoint, but from the stakes there. I mean, heavyweight champion of the world at the time when heavyweight champion meant something. Mike Tyson, this crazy, iconic cultural figure, it's just not the same. But I think what when someone shows you something that they don't think they have, that's one thing. But when someone shows you something that you don't think they have, and it's a high level of sophistication, it's fun to enjoy. And Joe Rogan's an emotional guy. He's an emotional commentator. Like, after crazy fights, he's like, that's the best fight I've ever seen. And then, you know, maybe a little later, he's like, okay, maybe it wasn't the best fight I've ever seen, but it was a really good fight. He gets hyped up by things. So, you know, listen, it's I often talk about this when I live blog or when I worked more on Bloody Elbow, when it used to be strictly reverse chronological in terms of how the posts were structured. You know, your initial take on something may not be your take 5 minutes or 5 days or 5 months later. Your thoughts and feelings can adapt and they can change and they can evolve. Joe Rogan's commentary is what it is. It's his commentary on fight night and how he sees it. Maybe he will hold it up later, and maybe he won't, you know, but you have to sort of wonder, that's his first take on it with no editing. With editing, I don't mean like some censorship. I mean like, you know, well, do I really feel that way? Is there really something I can defend? You know, you might find him wavering his opinion a little bit. Folks, we have to get out of here. Two things. One, thank you for joining me. Number two, I'm going to turn this into an MP3. I'll share it on Twitter, so follow me on Twitter, at @SBNLukeThomas. I'll make sure this video gets up, and then the MP3 as well, so you can put that into your car, and you can listen to it with your wife or girlfriend or your boyfriend, whoever you may have in your life, and you can annoy the crap out of them with my inane and semi-informed ramblings. Thank you for joining me. I will see you next week. We'll have coverage of everything for UFC this weekend. If you have any questions, email me, luke.thomas@sbnation.com. Until next time, stay frosty.